electrical short that would cost me more than the car is worth to have fixed. I put the key in the ignition and turn it, and nothing happens. I do all the stuff that normally works in this situation. I open and close the door, bang on the dash a few times, turn the heater to the off setting, jiggle the key, and try again. Nothing happens. I wait 5 minutes and try again. Nothing. This is a problem. I'm all the way across Lincoln, at least 20 miles from home. It's getting dark. I take out my phone and stare at my contacts list. I can't call Beaker. She's at play practice for Brigadoon. Eleanor doesn't have a car. Her mom drops her off everywhere. My own mom is working until 10. Crap. I could call Dad. We were supposed to have dinner tonight, Tuesday, as usual, but he left me a message earlier that he wanted to reschedule for Saturday morning. I check my watch. 5:17. He might be home by now. Megan's house is only a few miles from here. I know he'd be happy to come pick me up. I sigh and try the key one more time. Nothing. I've never called Dad, is the thing. Not since he left. He calls me if there are plans that need to be made. We meet at a rotating set of restaurants every week, and these meetings last about an hour at most. We talk about work. We talk about school. Sometimes he gives me money, an offering that communicates that he is sorry he messed up my life, words I know I will never hear him say out loud. I take his money. The bad father tax, I like to call it, which I don't feel bad about, since most of the savings my parents had put away for my college education was eaten up by the divorce. We have our rituals, our unspoken rules. We don't talk about Megan. We don't talk about Ty. I don't go to Megan's house. I don't call Dad at home. If I did that, it'd be like me saying it's okay what he did, like I'm accepting his new life, the one he built without us. I won't do it. I dial Sadie's cell, but she doesn't pick up. I dial her house. The phone rings and rings, and I'm about to hang up when I hear a disembodied voice.
Yeah, it says. I'm here, yo.
Seth? I ask, but who else could it be?
In the flesh, he says with a sleepy laugh. What can I do you for?
I try to ignore his atrocious grammar. Hi, it's Lex. Is Sadie home?
Sadie? Nope. Did you try her cell?
Yes, Seth, I tried her cell.
Well, I don't know what to tell you then. Do you want to leave a message?
No. I try the key one more time. Nothing. I beat my fist against the steering wheel. Stupid, stupid lemon. I was just hoping she could give me a ride home. My car's... stupid. Never mind.
I could give you a ride, Seth says. Where are you?
A ride? On your bike, you mean? I've seen Seth tearing around the neighborhood on that thing. It makes so much noise you can hardly miss it. He snorts.
On my Kawasaki Ninja 300. Her name is Georgia, because she's a peach.
Right. I try to picture it, me balancing precariously behind Seth on his motorcycle, clutching him around the middle as we careen 20 miles over the icy roads across town. No thanks, Seth, I decline as politely as I can. I can get someone else to pick me up. I only called because I thought Sadie might want to hang out.
Oh, so me and Georgia aren't good enough for you?
He says, his voice teasing.
Come on, Lex. Where are you at?
It's okay, I say quickly. You probably have to be at work soon, and I'm all the way downtown, and I don't want to inconvenience you.
Lex.
There's someone else who can come get me, I say again. It's no problem. Thanks for the offer, though. Some other time I'd love to ride... Georgia, okay?
You sure?
Positive. Thanks. I hang up. I try to start the engine again. Nothing. I hate the lemon. Crap, I say to nobody. Crap! I get a flash of Ty's face, a memory of his brow furrowed in frustration when I taught him to drive. Crap, he said. He tugged on the shift, making the lemon groan in protest.
I'll never get this.
You will, I told him. But hopefully you'll get it before you ruin my transmission. The car died.
Crap!
Ty roared. He'd been so moody lately, every 10 minutes switching to a different wild emotion. I chalked it up to shifting hormones. It's a terrible thing to be a teenage boy. I put my hand over his on the shift, and for a minute I was mad, too, that it was me teaching him and not Dad. It should have been Dad. "Hey," I said to Ty, "it's okay. Take a breath." He leaned back in the driver's seat, exhaled forcefully through his nose, and rubbed at his bloodshot eyes. He'd started wearing contact lenses a few weeks earlier. I was still trying to get used to seeing him without his glasses.
"I suck," he said. "I should just take the bus."
"You do suck," I agreed. "But, you know, pretty much everybody sucks at first, and everybody learns to drive sooner or later, the same way everybody learns how to walk. Step by step. Put your foot on the clutch." I reached over and turned the key in the ignition, and that time, which happened more than a year ago, the lemon started right up. "You can do this," I told him. "No big deal." He nodded, smiled faintly.
"Thanks."
And then he drove. Not well, not that time, but he got us from point A to point B. I blink against the memory. I turn the key, but the engine doesn't make a sound. Maybe the battery's dead this time. Maybe my crap car has finally gone belly up. I'm hosed. Of course, there is someone else I could call. I wasn't lying when I said that to Seth. Someone who would definitely come and get me. Someone not Dad. I stare at my phone. It would be awkward. Embarrassing. Pathetic, even. But what other choice do I have? I swallow hard. "I can do this," I whisper, and then I press send. "No big deal." 20 minutes later, Stephen's little car, a blue Toyota Corolla that he shares with his older sister Sarah, pulls up next to the lemon. His brakes squeak as he comes to a stop. He rolls down the window.
"Do you want me to try to jump you?" he asks.
"Don't bother. I want him to expend as little effort here as possible. I just need to get home." He leans to unlock the passenger door and clears a bunch of books and papers off the seat so I can sit down. He waits while I put my seatbelt on, then clears his throat and backs us out of the parking lot. We head north on O Street. It's fully dark now, and a light snow is falling, catching the streetlights. We make small talk for a while. The weather, cold as always, Ms. Mahoney, awesome as always, and college plans, still waiting to get our acceptance letters. Then we hit Wayuka Cemetery, its heavy black iron fence stretching along the edge of the road, the graves, old trees, and mausoleums looming beyond it. Stephen and I stop talking as we pass. He clears his throat again, his expression suddenly clouded.
"Lex," he starts.
I say, "I know I shouldn't have called you, but there was nobody else. I'm sorry. It won't happen again."
"Of course you should have called me," he says sharply. "We're still friends, aren't we? I thought we were still friends."
"I don't know," I admit. If the definition of the word friend is someone you're comfortable with, someone it feels good to be around, then Stephen and I are definitely not friends.
"I'd like us to be friends, Lex," he says.
But even coming from him, it sounds like a lie.
"Do you want to get something to eat?"
he asks as we turn on to 27th.
"There's the Imperial Palace coming up."
My favorite Chinese place. That's where we went out to dinner that night. Does Stephen remember? "No," I say quickly before he can turn into the parking lot. "I have dinner waiting for me at home." An obvious lie. "Plus I have a ton of homework I need to get to," I throw in for good measure. He doesn't call me out on it. We drive for a while, past the restaurant, past a video arcade we always used to go to, past the flower shop where he bought my corsage for the homecoming dance, and where we got Ty's funeral flowers. It's so quiet, I feel like my head is going to implode. Stephen reaches for the radio dial, but pauses before he turns it on.
"Music?"
"Oh, God, yes, music. Yes, please." We're flooded with Yo-Yo Ma's cello playing Bach's Suite No. 1 in G major. I close my eyes and let the notes wash over me. This was a bad idea, I think, for the 1,000th time. but at least we're more than halfway home.
So,
Steven says, just when it feels like I might survive this little joyride.
You still won't call your dad, huh?
My eyes open. He's looking at the road, the light from the oncoming headlights moving in lines across his face, but it feels like he's looking at me. No, I don't call him. Nothing has changed on that front.
That's too bad. I thought maybe, with Ty, it might bring you two together,
he says. I don't want to be together with my dad, I snap. We stop at a red. Steven looks at me. The bark is suddenly not enough to drown the silence.
Why not?
He asks. If my dad hadn't left us, Ty would still be alive. It surprises me when I say it. I didn't know I actually believed it, not in such simple terms anyway, until the words left my mouth. But I do believe it.
You don't know that,
Steven says. I don't need you to be my therapist, Steven, I say, my sudden anger welcome against whatever else it is that I'm feeling. I have a therapist.
Then what do you need me to be?
He asks, and pins me with those well-meaning brown eyes.
Tell me what you need, Lex, and I'll do that. I'll be that.
I look away. It's green.
What?
The light's green.
Oh.
He steps on the gas. Then he reaches up and turns off the music. Sighs.
I wish you'd talk to me, he says. Tell me what's going on with you. I know we're not together anymore, and I respect your wishes about that, but that doesn't mean I've stopped caring about you.
I'll tell you what I don't need, I interrupt. I don't need sneaky love poems. I don't need you calling my house to check up on me. I don't need to feel like you're always there breathing down my neck. That's what I don't need. He looks confused.
What?
I don't want to talk about it, I say. I need a ride home, okay? His jaw tightens.
Okay.
We go the rest of the way, 10 long minutes, without saying another word. I jump out before we've even fully stopped in my driveway. Thanks for the ride. I'm gone before he can form a response. I duck through the first door that's available, the side door to the garage, but I don't close the door behind me all the way. I leave it open a crack, and watch Steven as he sits for a while, his eyes closed, his hands gripping the wheel. I'm hurting him. Still. I was right to hesitate when Steven asked me to go out with him. Of course I was right. We were destined to break up, the way all early romances are doomed. And now things are awkward with our friends, and we are hurting each other. I was right. He opens his eyes and backs the car out, then drives off fast, spraying snow and gravel. I close the door. That's when I realize that I'm in the garage. I gaze at the spot where my brother died. They cleaned it up after, some company that does that. There's no blood here now, no dark stain to mark the place, but there is a chip in the cement. I can't remember if it was there before or if it was created by the bullet after it passed through, which makes me immediately start considering angles and trajectory and velocity, and I don't want to think about that. I look around at the last things Ty would have seen, the rusty rakes and shovels lining the wall, the grass-encrusted lawnmower, our broken snowblower, the old wheelbarrow with a flat tire, the barrel of dog food that's still here even though our dog died a year ago. It smells like dust and motor oil and plants decaying. It's a depressing place to die, dark and cold and dingy. I imagine the shot, how it must have filled this space with its noise, how it must have deafened him in those few seconds he could hear. I imagine the gunpowder curling in the air, the smell of blood, the chill of the cement against his cheek as his vision faded. He would have felt so alone here. I go inside to the kitchen. I stand for a few minutes staring into the refrigerator, which is like a barren wasteland, it's so empty, but that's fine because I'm not hungry anymore. I take out a bottle of Mom's mandatory Diet Coke, which I've been trying to get her to quit on account of the nasty chemicals, and I chug it. The bubbles burn my nose. I'm almost finished with it when I think I see, out of the corner of my eye, a figure in the reflection of the kitchen window, a flash, Ty. But when I lower the bottle, when I turn, he's gone. Of course. I toss the bottle in the recycling bin and put my back to the window. From here, I have a view of the top of the stairwell. The empty frame of Dad's graduation photo gleams at me like it's trying to get my attention. Oh, that's right, I think. The mystery. How would Sherlock Holmes go about solving this case? Well, I reason, first it might be a good idea to check to see if there are any other photos missing from where they ought to be, or if the hunting picture and Dad's graduation picture are the only two. That'd be a start. I do a quick mental rundown of where there are pictures. Then I check the mantle over the fireplace in the living room, but nothing's out of order there. I try Dad's office, where there's still a silver-framed photo of him and Mom on their 15th wedding anniversary. Dad didn't take it when he left. Mom's never taken it down. It's still there, a dusty example of the kind of parental units I used to have. I try the guest bathroom, where years ago Mom framed several photos of Ty and me taking baths together as toddlers, all the private places covered with bubbles, but humiliating nonetheless. All those pictures are still in place. Outside of the motherlode and the stairwell, I can't think of anywhere there are framed photos. Nothing else is missing. Back to square one. Clearly, I'm no Sherlock Holmes. But who says they have to be framed photos, it occurs to me suddenly. That sends me to a particular shelf on the bookcase in the basement den, where there's a row of photo albums. Mom and Dad's wedding, their honeymoon, family vacations, and then our baby books, mine and Ty's both. Mine is full and well-maintained. Mom carefully filled out the family tree and all the details about my birth, like I was born at 9:46 at night after 11 hours of labor, and I had excellent Apgar scores, and the first 3 months of my life I spent approximately 3.5 hours a day crying for no good reason at all, which is just under the clinical definition of colic. She has the dates and times of all my first accomplishments, my first bath, my first smile, my first steps and words, Dada, then Doggy, then Mama, which totally offended my mother, my first teeth, my first haircut, my first friend, where it says Sadie McIntyre in Mom's perfect cursive, as if I really want to know that stuff. Ty's baby book is slimmer. By the time Ty came along, Mom had her hands full with me and no time to spend lovingly documenting every moment of his life. The second kid always gets shafted in the picture department. He's lucky, I suppose, that he has any photos in his book at all. It's hard to thumb through it, but I do. Ty as a fat and purple sleeping lump. Ty as an adorable chubby toddler. Ty on a camping trip, wearing Dad's Jeep baseball hat, drinking a can of grape Fanta with a straw. Ty petting Sunny. Ty in bed, on Elmo sheets, with his dimpled hands clasped and his eyes closed, saying his prayers. Now I lay me down to sleep. I skip over the pictures of Ty and me because something in my chest twists when I look at them, all this carefully archived evidence of what we've lost. His first word was Mama, incidentally. Kiss up. It doesn't take long for me to realize that there are photos missing in this book, too, not just places Mom was too busy to fill in, but empty spaces with the residue of double-sided tape still marking the page. But unlike the framed photos that are MIA, his baby book photos aren't something I have memorized. I don't know what's gone. All I can do at this point is make an educated guess here and there and count the spots where I conclude that a photo has been removed. 8 photos in all, which brings us to a grand total of 10 missing photos. I'm still no closer to understanding what's going on here, or why. I hear footsteps on the floor above me. Part of me freezes for about 3 seconds, until I recognize the sound of Mom's jingling keys. She has a rhythm when she gets home. Open the coat closet by the door, hang up her coat, walk to the kitchen and set down the mail in the tray on the kitchen counter. Open one of the cabinets and stick in her purse and her keys. Make herself a cup of instant coffee, or, more recently, a wine cooler or glass of wine. I'm starting to fear for her liver. I glance at the clock on the cable box near the basement TV. 6:07. Mom shouldn't be home yet. I take the stairs 2 at a time. Mom yelps when I pop up at the top. Hey, I say. Get off early? "How was your day?" she asks me, sliding by my question. "Oh, you know, Mom," I think. "Fan-freaking-tastic." "The lemon died," I report. "I don't know if she's coming back this time. She's still in the parking lot at Dave's." "Oh, no," Mom exclaims. "How did you get home?" "I had to get a ride with Stephen." "Oh." This has got to be the most loaded "oh" a person has ever uttered. "Yeah," I affirm. "Awkward city." Her expression softens. Mom understands breakups. She gives a stilted laugh. "That car of yours definitely has the right name, doesn't it?" I nod. "If only we had some..." she starts to say, and then stops herself. "If only we had some money to buy a new car." I try not to scrutinize our family's financial situation, because if I do, it becomes abundantly clear how my parents' divorce was the key contributor to all our current cash flow troubles, and there's nothing I can do with that information but be mad about it. But I pay attention to numbers. I know that Ty's death cost $10,995. The casket alone was $2,300, plus all the funeral home fees, embalming, body storage, a cost to rent the mortuary space for the wake, etc., which added up to around $3,895, plus what they charged for the body retrieval and cleanup, $400, plus the flowers, $200, plus the grave space at Wayuka, $1,300, and the cost to dig the grave, $1,000, and finally the headstone, which was an even $2,000. Mom is a registered nurse, but she's been on the job for less than a year, so she makes $20.25 an hour. She had a life insurance policy on both Ty and me, but because Ty's death was a suicide, the insurance company declared that his policy was void. Dad pitched in for half the cost, of course, but he's not rolling in cash either. See, divorce lawyers and court fees and the money he had to fork over for Mom's nursing school after he left. In other words, we're broke. See Lexi drive a clunker. "I don't really need a car," I tell Mom now. "When I'm at MIT next year, I'll take the subway. Cambridge has excellent public transportation, which is safer, statistically speaking, than driving a car." She smiles sadly and pats my hair. I don't know if she believes that I'll get into MIT, but she'll act like she does. She'll indulge me. "Good. Then it will be one less thing to worry about," she says. "Now let's go figure out what we're going to do with the lemon. Then we can get dinner." Ironically, the lemon starts right up for me when we go back for it, without a hitch or a sputter or anything. She just purrs to life. "Wouldn't start, huh?" Mom says from her vantage point in the next parking space over. "Are you sure that's what happened?" She gives me a look like maybe this whole charade with Stephen giving me a ride home may have been a ruse on my part, to spend time with Stephen, because of course I must still like Stephen, because he's such an upstanding young man. Maybe Mom doesn't understand breakups. "I swear, the car likes to mess with me," I say. "She's temperamental." Mom nods knowingly, and then moves on to the dinner plan. "How about the Imperial Palace?" she suggests. "You love that place." "Meh," I shrug. "It's only marginally good." She accepts what I say at face value. "All right. We can do better than marginally good, I think." "How about the Spaghetti Works? We haven't been there in forever." "Because it's too expensive. Not ridiculously expensive, but too expensive for us. I heard they have a $6 spaghetti special. All you can eat." "Spaghetti sounds wonderful," she says. "I could use a glass of red wine about now." 16. Time passes. That's the rule. No matter what happens, no matter how much it might feel like everything in your life has frozen around one particular moment, time marches on. After my brother died, time passed slowly, with me trudging through all the obligatory activities that I was still expected to do. Class, eating, sleeping, brushing my teeth, drying my hair, pretending like I gave a crap. Either that, or time disappeared. I found myself on the other side of Christmas without remembering more than an ambiguous pine-scented blur. A calculus final, gone. Whole conversations that I don't have any memory of. Now, suddenly, I find that it's March 3rd. A big day. A day I was waiting for. The first possible day that I could have expected to hear anything from MIT. After school, I go to the mailbox, and there, tucked in the shadows, big and beautiful, is a fat envelope. I've been trying not to think about MIT too much, to refrain from obsessing like some people do, or get my hopes unrealistically high. There are other schools, after all, other perfectly decent institutions of higher learning. But MIT is the institution, and somewhere deep inside me, I expected this. I hoped for it anyway. I dreamed. I don't bother going inside. I tear the letter open and read it standing next to the mailbox. Dear Alexis, on behalf of the admissions committee, it is my pleasure to offer you admission to MIT. You stood out as one of the most talented and promising students in the most competitive applicant pool in the history of the Institute. Your commitment to personal excellence and principled goals has convinced us that you will both contribute to our community and thrive within our academic environment. We think that you and MIT are a great match. I swallow down the hard lump in my throat and scan past the details. I have until May 2nd to let them know whether I accept their offer. They invite me to attend something called Campus Preview Weekend in April to get a sense of what life on campus would be like. An MIT student will be calling me in the coming weeks, and they urge me to look over the details of my financial aid package. I flip forward, and my breath catches. More than $43,000 in scholarships. I read on. And now for the requisite fine print. I must remind you that this offer of admission is contingent upon your completing the school year with flying colors. Have fun for the rest of your senior year, but please keep your grades up. I hope you'll agree with us that MIT is the perfect place to prepare for your future. As a member of our community, you'll join builders, scholars, entrepreneurs, and humanitarians. Together, you will all make a difference in a world that desperately needs you. Many congratulations, and once again, welcome to MIT. Now stop reading this and go celebrate. This is happening. This is what I've wanted from the time I knew what college was about. To get out of Nebraska, to study math with the country's best instructors, to bounce my ideas off the sharpest minds, to become someone of consequence. I don't want to be rich or famous, but I want to contribute something significant to the history of human thought. The Riggs Theorem. That's my immortality, my idea of heaven. Something people will remember me for after I die. As I walk back to the house, I'm surprised by how, with this letter finally in my hands, I'm not that excited. Not the kind of excited I thought I'd be. I'm going to MIT. Okay. Yes, this is what I wanted. Yes, this is, without a doubt, the most awesome thing ever to happen to me. Yes. Yes. But that will mean leaving Mom all alone in this house. I sit down on the living room couch and read the letter again. I force myself to imagine it. Me standing at a blackboard at MIT, going all Will Hunting on some problem. Me curled up on a twin bed in a tiny but mine dorm room, reading about quantum mechanics. Me strolling along some tree-lined sidewalk, chatting with the other students, a stack of heavy books under my arm. It's nice, thinking about the future as something that won't entirely suck. But things are different now than they were when I filled out my college applications. March 5th. I haven't told my parents. Not Dave, when we had our session yesterday. Not my friends. I don't know how to slip it into the conversation at school. I guess it should be as simple as, guess what? I got into MIT. Hooray, hooray! But whenever that pause happens, when I could make the announcement, I choke. If I tell people, they're all going to watch me for my super elated reaction. And I'm not Beaker. I'm no great actress. I'm happy I got into MIT. I am. But I don't know if I can do happy at this stage in my life. Not in public. Not at the level they're all going to expect. Still, I bring the acceptance letter with me, tucked in with the Ashley letter in the front pocket of my 5-subject notebook, and every now and then I open the notebook and stare at the envelope and think of all the promises collected in this one place, all the hope. Maybe that's it, what's holding me back from telling people. The hope. I'm not used to hope anymore. It's hardest to hold the MIT news inside me during calculus. We're learning how to find volumes of rotations using integrations, and Stephen is up at the board writing out these gorgeous equations, his handwriting so much neater than mine and so much more careful, which is why Miss Mahoney called him up there, so he could show us the answer the way a painter might create a still life that looks like V cone is equal pi times the integral between 0 and 2 of f of y all squared dy. This is then equal pi times the integral between 0 and 2 of 3 over 2y all squared dy, which in turn equals pi times the integral between 0 and 2 of 9 over 4y squared dy, which then equals pi times integrand 3/4 y cubed with limits 0 and 2, which just equals 6 pi. So, Miss Mahoney says when he's nearly finished, let's say Stephen is a glassblower, crafting a vase. He could use this method to understand the different shapes he's making and the amount of water the vase would hold.
Yeah, Stephen, Elle snickers. You're a glassblower.
He grins and shrugs one shoulder.
It's a job.
What kind of vase are we talking about here? Pipes up Beaker. What color of glass? I've always been fond of blue glass. Can you do a blue glass vase for us, Stephen?
All righty, he says, and turns back to the board. Blue glass coming up.
The class laughs, and we understand it's a tad lame, but I've always appreciated the way Miss Mahoney tries to give us real-world applications for the things we learn, so it's not just math in a box. She wants us to see the beauty in the equations, how absolutely cool it all is, but she also wants it to be real for us. It never fails to amaze me, in these moments, that the numbers explain something tangible and true about life. The numbers make sense of things. They make order of a disordered world. I want to say thank you to Miss Mahoney for giving me that, for trying to make it fun and not just neat, unnecessary knowledge. I want to say, hey, Miss Mahoney, I got into MIT. Then I want to tell Beaker and Elle, after all the daydreaming we did, MIT is a real place and I am going there. I'm going there. I want to tell Stephen, but I can't find the words. Words were never really my forte. 17. When I get home, I find Mom's car in the driveway. That's twice now that she's been home when she's supposed to be working. I go inside and call for her, but she doesn't answer. Some part of me goes into panic mode, and I run to her bedroom, holding my breath until I can confirm that she's not sprawled across the bed with her arm trailing off the mattress, a spilled bottle of pills scattered on the carpet. Where did I get that image, I wonder, the go-to scene of fatal overdose that you always see in movies? Why did my mind go straight to the worst possibility? Because it happened, I answer myself. The worst possibility already happened once. It could happen again. Mom? I yell. There's no answer. I check Mom's bathroom, Dad's office, and the kitchen without success, which gets the adrenaline flowing again. She could be out with a friend, I reason. Then I come across her purse on the kitchen counter, her phone inside it. Her coat is slung across a kitchen stool. Everything here, but nothing in its proper place. Mom! I scream. Mom! I stand still for a minute, holding my breath, listening. Then I hear it. Music. Very faint music. Coming from downstairs. I find Mom in Ty's room. Led Zeppelin is pouring out of Ty's clock radio. Stairway to Heaven, a song that he and Patrick and Damien used to play on a constant loop back in middle school, again and again and again until Mom and I could have sung the lyrics in our sleep. Mom is standing with her back to me, hands pressed to a Kevin Durant making a slam dunk poster on the far wall. My heart sinks. She's taking down his room. It was going to happen at some point, I suppose.
Hi, I rasp. I was looking everywhere for you. Did you hear me calling?
She shakes her head. Her small shoulders are trembling. She's crying again.
Are you okay? I ask. I've been better.
She takes a deep breath and then smooths the poster down, pinning a corner with a gold thumbtack. She's putting it back up, I realize, not taking it down. I scan the room and spot a large cardboard box near the bed that contains more of Ty's stuff. His basketball jersey, a mason jar of 50-cent pieces he collected from the Tooth Fairy, a tie he wore to church sometimes, a belt, his baseball cards. There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven, intones Robert Plant. The smell of Ty's cologne is so heavy it makes me want to cough.
Mom, what's going on? I ask.
She wipes at her face. Then she reaches and turns down the music.
I called in sick.
She goes to the box and removes another poster, The Hangover Part 2, and goes about realigning it in its former place on the wall.
Could you help me?
I unfreeze my feet and hold the paper up for her as she carefully guides the tacks back into their original holes.
Redecorating?
I venture.
Gail was here. She brought that.
Mom indicates the box.
She thought it was time for me to pack up.
She bends her head, gasps for air as the tears drop into the carpet.
Tyler's things. She said it would help me. Move on.
I bite my lip to keep from bursting out with furious words for Gail. How dare she, I think. How dare she come here and decide what's best for everyone?
Gail wants me to sell the house, Mom continues. She wants me to move to Lincoln, closer to the hospital, so it's not so much trouble to drive into work. She says I should get a smaller place, since Tyler's gone, and you're going off to school, and it will only be me. She also wants me to take a new job that's come up in the neonatal intensive care unit. Work with the babies, instead of having to deal with all the people who keep dying on me in the surgical wing.
Sounds like Gail has it all figured out. I sit on the edge of Ty's bed. Mom reaches into her pocket for a crumpled-up tissue. She blows her nose and goes back to the box, where she takes out an old catcher's mitt from when Ty was in Little League.
Where did this go?
She whispers. Her eyes dart around the room.
I can't remember.
Top right corner of the bookshelf, I answer automatically. She nods.
That's right, of course. You always had such a perfect memory, a photographic memory.
She makes no move to return the glove to its place. She stands there holding it, rubbing her fingers along its smooth leather surface.
I volunteered to coach T-ball that one year. Do you remember?
I remember.
I got this book called Coaching T-Ball, The Baffled Parent's Guide. I didn't know anything about baseball.
You learned.
Tyler was mortified to see me standing up there in front of everybody with that book.
He got over it. She stares at the mitt.
I tried,
she says after a minute.
I know. No, I mean, I tried to do what Gail said. I tried to take it all down, put it away. I even thought about calling his friends and asking them if they would want some of it, but...
She takes a shuddering breath.
I can't. I can't let go.
She starts crying for real now, in big, gasping sobs. I jump up to hold her.
I can't,
she cries against my shoulder.
I can't.
The hole opens up in my chest, and I cling to her, and it's as if the pain passes back and forth between us, until she goes limp in my arms. I guide her to sit down on the bed.
I have big news,
I say softly.
Good news.
Because we could both use some good news right now. She looks up at me, bewildered, tear-streaked.
What? I got into MIT.
Her face opens up like a flower in the sun. She pulls away and stares at me for several moments, not talking,
just looking at me with an expression that says maybe there is a God after all, who has answered her prayers.
"I'm glad,"
she whispers when she regains her powers of speech.
"I'm so glad, Lexi."
I try to smile.
"Me too." "Now you can go," she says fiercely.
"I can go?" I don't understand. She takes me by the shoulders and gives me a gentle shake.
"You can build a new life for yourself. That's what I want, for you to get away from this place. I want you to go to Massachusetts and never look back."
She says it like we're the last people in line for a lifeboat on a sinking ship, telling me to leave her, telling me to let her drown.
"It doesn't have to be like that," I croak. "You can build a new life for yourself, too."
She lets go of me and turns away.
"No, my life is over."
I'm shocked to hear her say it that way. She was always an optimist before. Even when Dad left, after she got over the initial shock, she kept saying, "He'll come to his senses. He'll come back. We'll go along the best we can until then. This isn't the end of the world." Even though it clearly was. The end of our world, anyway. And now she's saying her life is over.
"Mom..."
I don't even know where to start. She's not looking at me anymore. She's staring at the mirror with the post-it and the words below empty.
"You're not dead," I say, my voice sharper than I mean it to be. "You're alive. It's hard now, but you'll heal. You can still be happy someday."
She goes to the bookshelf and returns the catcher's mitt to its proper place.
"No, sweetie," she says in her official parenting voice, like I'm 10 all over again and she's telling me the facts of life. "I'll never be happy. How could I, when he's not here? When I have failed him this way? No, no, I will not heal from this. My life is over," she says. "If you weren't here, I'd..."
She trails off.
"If I wasn't here, you'd what?"
She shakes her head.
"Nothing."
She tries to give me a reassuring smile.
"Don't worry about me, Lexi. I'll be fine. I won't be happy. I can't be. But I'll be fine."
I watch in silence as she continues unpacking the box, helping her find where an item belongs if she doesn't remember. Then there's only one thing left to deal with. The collage frame that Ty filled up in the days before he died, the one with the pictures of his friends and family. That doesn't have a place where it belongs. After the funeral, somebody stuck it behind his bedroom door, and it's been there ever since. Mom lays it on the bed and looks at it.
"I don't know what to do with this. I could take the photos out and send them to the people in them, but I can't remember their names. Isn't that silly? I honestly don't know who most of these people are."
She points to a picture on one edge.
"I remember Damien and Patrick, the three amigos I used to call them. And I remember the boys he played with when he was in elementary school. But his friends now? I was in nursing school by then. I didn't pay as close attention as I should have. I don't know them. What kind of mother am I that I didn't know his friends? It's okay, Mom."
She shakes her head. We stand for a few minutes looking at the pictures. One depicts Mom giving Ty a bath when he was just a baby, which seems odd that he would want people to see that picture. But Mom is so beautiful in it. She's wearing curlers and a plaid shirt with the sleeves rolled up, one hand cupping Ty's round baby head, the other dragging a washcloth over him. She's looking up into the camera with half a smile, chagrined to be caught so undone. And she looks incredibly young and vibrant and, at the same time, maternal and sweet. She looks like a different person from the woman standing beside me now. In another corner, I spot the picture Mom took of Ty and me the night of homecoming, me in my green dress, Ty in his tux and his flawlessly makeup-covered forehead. He wanted people to see that, too, us together, his arm around me. That's something. It's not an explanation or a goodbye, but it's something. And suddenly it hits me. The missing photographs. This is where Ty must have put the missing photographs. I scan the collage again, but there's no picture of Ty and Dad hunting, no picture of Dad at graduation, no picture of Dad here at all. Like she can read my mind, Mom points to an empty slot in the collage, the only empty slot, which makes it seem deliberately empty. I noticed it at the funeral, but didn't give it too much thought. Now, though, Mom is looking at it with a sorrowful expression.
"Your dad should have gone here," she murmurs. "That was cruel of Tyler, leaving him out."
Cruel is not a word that I would ever use to describe Ty.
"Dad probably didn't even notice," I say. "He noticed."
Mom touches her finger to the glass.
"I watched him that day, keeping in the back of the church, out of our way, because he wanted to stay by..."
Her lips tighten.
"But near the end, when the crowd was thinning, he came up and looked at this. He went from picture to picture looking. And he never found himself there."
"Maybe Dad doesn't deserve to be there," I argue. She sighs.
"Maybe not. But you should have seen his face when he realized he wasn't included. He looked about as hurt as I've ever seen him. Then he just put his hands in his pockets and walked away. It was cruel. I didn't think Tyler had that kind of vindictiveness in him."
"Ty was angry," I said. "He had every right to..." Mom lifts her hand to stop me.
"I know. I just wish he hadn't ended things that way."
I chew on my bottom lip, thinking. I look at the collage again, and then I suddenly notice that right in the middle, in a place of prominence even, there's a picture of Ashley Davenport. Not the homecoming picture of Ty and Ashley, but a black and white candid shot, taken by someone who was obviously trying to be artsy with the camera. It shows Ashley and two other cheerleaders in what must have been the seconds right after the basketball team made a basket, wearing their uniforms, smiling and jumping for the crowd in the background, their eyes bright, so full of action, even in the picture, that I can almost hear their shouts. Mom sees what I'm looking at.
"They're so pretty, aren't they?" she says. "Teenage girls are at the height of pretty, like flowers just as they bloom."
I cock my head at her. "Me too. Am I a flower?" She gives me an attempt at a smile.
"You're a flower."
"Did you know this girl?" I ask, tapping the glass over the cheerleader photo.
"She was Tyler's girlfriend," Mom says. "Ashley. He brought her over to the house for dinner once."
My mouth falls open. "He did? Where was I?"
"A math club competition, if memory serves."
She sighs, remembering.
"We had pot roast I made in the slow cooker. She actually brought an apple pie that she baked herself. She was lovely, inside and out, that girl. You could see it in her, a good girl, sweet. Just the right kind of girl for Tyler to be with."
She looks away. "Do you know why they broke up?" I ask softly. She shakes her head.
"He didn't tell me."
"I thought she dumped him, but..." My gaze returns to the picture.
"I guess he wasn't too mad at her if he'd put her picture up here." "I don't know if you could really be mad at a girl like that,"
Mom says wistfully. "Wow," I think. She was imagining grandbabies and everything, it seems. Mom's mouth pinches up, like all this talk about Ty's lost romantic prospects is painful to her. She picks up the collage and moves it behind the door, then takes one last long look at Ty's room. She sighs, pulls a tissue out of her pocket, and blows her nose.
"Come on,"
she says.
"We're done in here."
She turns out the light. 5th of March. I don't know why, maybe because I love torturing myself, but I keep going back to the first day Stephen and I were officially together. Not to the bookstore, or the date, or the kiss after, although I think about those things often enough, my own personal memory playlist that's on a continuous loop, but to a conversation I had later about Stephen, with Ty. After Stephen dropped me off, I floated inside on cloud 9, bursting with all that had happened in the past few hours. Mom was working, so I couldn't girl talk with her about it. I found my brother in the basement, bowling on the Wii. Where have you been all day? He asked when he saw me coming down the stairs, his arm swinging back as he delivered the virtual ball to the gutter. He groaned.
Around. I saw a movie at South Point, I replied.
Wow, you're not even good at virtual bowling.
Shut up,
Ty said good-naturedly, and reset the Wii so that we could both play.
Loser buys the winner McDonald's.
Then he proceeded to kick my bowling butt.
How was the movie? He said after a while.
Okay, heavy on visuals, light on plot, I replied. I was going to leave it at that, but I wanted to tell him. I wanted to share a part of this monumental day in my life. So I said, I went with Steven.
Ty's eyes didn't leave the TV screen.
The guy from your math club or whatever?
Steven Blake, yes.
What did you used to call him, like his geek nickname?
Oh, I said, laughing that he remembered. In middle school, we all used to have nicknames. Mine was Luther. After Superman's Lex Luthor, the world's greatest criminal mastermind, Eleanor's was Roosevelt, which she loathed and rallied to change to Rigby after the Beatles song, but never pulled off. Beaker's was the only one that actually stuck past eighth grade. And Stevens was...
Hawking, I told Ty.
After the star guy.
After the world-famous astrophysicist and cosmologist, which means he studies the origins and structure of the universe.
Sheesh. Star guy.
Yes!
Ty rolled a perfect strike. I was beginning to suspect that he was hustling me for McDonald's.
So, you went on a date. How was that?
It wasn't supposed to be a date, but it ended up that way. It was good. Really good, actually. I picked up my controller and immediately bowled a gutter ball.
Crap. I approve of this Hawking dude,
Ty said as I lamely managed to knock down a few pins on my next roll.
Of course, if he breaks your heart, I'm going to have to beat him up. Brotherly duty, you know.
Thanks. I smiled and nodded and didn't say anything else Stephen related that night. We bowled, and I lost. We must have gone to McDonald's, but I guess I blocked that part out. That was the last time I agreed to play Wii with my brother. It was also the last time we had anything resembling a real conversation about our personal lives, when he said he approved of Stephen. I wish I'd told him more. I could have talked about Stephen, although not about the kissing, because no brother wants to hear about his sister making out. I could have told him about how brave Stephen had been, to just ask me point blank like that, how gentlemanly he'd been for the rest of the time, and how, in spite of my modern feminist misgivings, I'd kind of liked that. I could have told him about the paper daisy or the things I liked about Stephen, the way he made me laugh, how he infected me with his enthusiasm, his wonder, and made me feel like I was pretty when nobody else had ever really made me feel that way, which shouldn't have been so important, but was. I could have shared that with Ty. If I had, maybe he would have felt comfortable doing the same. Maybe he would have let me in, that snow day when we talked about Ashley and the breakup, instead of insisting that it was nothing, that nothing had happened, that everything was fine. Maybe he would have given me the details I need to understand what went down between them, the facts I'd use to figure out what to do with this letter. Because he didn't hate Ashley. She might have broken his heart, but he still put her picture up in his collage, which meant that he still considered her a friend. 18. On Thursday, I caused some general confusion among our respective friends by asking Sadie to eat lunch with me. I pick a table for us in the cafeteria where I can keep an eye on Ashley Davenport. The letter is stuck under the edge of my tray, where my food sits untouched. I'm too busy to eat. I'm watching this girl who was so important to my brother that he wrote her a letter before he died. I'm planning to make my move. I'm thankful that seniors and sophomores, by sheer coincidence, have the same lunch period. So far, I've learned way more about Ashley in the cafeteria than I did in the gym. Like, she waves at nearly everyone who passes as they make their way down the lunch line. She's friendly, and they wave back. She's popular. She picks all the tiny chopped carrots out of her salad. She's trying to lose weight, which she nibbles with her fingers. She has bad table manners, and she laughs a lot. She has good teeth. She seems like a nice girl, a lovely girl, like my mom said, inside and out. Over at my regular table, table dweeb as we like to call it, Beaker catches my eye. She keeps looking worriedly from me to Sadie and back again, like she can't believe this turn of events. Me and the shoplifter. What the heck is going on? She may be forced to stage some kind of intervention. Next to her, Elle glances over and gives me a smile, which I don't know how to interpret. I don't know what to make of her smiling at me. Maybe now it's easier for her to like me at a distance? And then, of course, there's Stephen. He's reading, his tall frame curled awkwardly in the metal cafeteria chair, his head bent over his book. He pushes his glasses up on his nose and drags his lower lip between his teeth, something he does when he's thinking all the deep thoughts. He rests his forehead against his fist, then jots something down in the margins. I love that he writes in books. "Hey," Sadie whispers to me urgently. "Here's your chance." I look up at Sadie. "What?" She jerks her head in Ashley's direction. I turn back. Sure enough, Ashley's friends are getting up. They give their faint, "see you at practices," and "love yous," and then they're gone. Ashley sits picking at her carrot slivers alone. It's like the universe is giving me this opportunity, if I believed in that sort of thing. Ashley reaches into the backpack at her feet and pulls out a book, Persuasion, by Jane Austen. Yes, she even freaking reads classic literature. This girl is too good to be true. It's time. I slide out the letter and stand up. All of a sudden, my heart starts beating like a brass band. Womp, womp, womp. "You can do it," Sadie whispers. I can do it. I can take 20 steps across the cafeteria and hand a letter to a girl. I can say, "Hi, Ty left this for you, so here." And then I can give it to her and I can turn around and walk away, so I won't see her face when she reads it. Or maybe she won't read it here, with all these people around. Maybe she'll go to the library and find that empty corner behind the stacks. That's what I would do. Or maybe she'll wait until she gets home. And maybe I should be more discreet. We're in the middle of a crowded cafeteria. People will notice. People will be listening. I could say, "Hi, can I talk to you?" and lead her to that empty corner of the library and give it to her there. If she'd come with me. But people would notice that, too, and then they might ask her about it. I could mail it to her. But then maybe her mom would find the letter first and read it, and maybe there's sensitive information in there. Ty could have mailed it to her if he'd wanted that. Maybe her dad would read it, and maybe she and Ty had sex, and he wrote about that, and it would ruin her relationship with her father forever. All of this goes through my mind, and more. More questions, more junk, more variables. I'm 10 steps in the right direction now. 10 to go. Someone says Ashley's name. She looks up from her book and lays it on the table, and smiles blindingly, a happy, excited smile. She jumps up and throws herself into a guy's arms. Not just any guy, either. Grayson. One of my brother's friends.
"I was just thinking about you," Ashley says.
They kiss. Not a long kiss, nothing passionate or showy or French, but a quick peck that says, "We're together. We kiss all the time and it's no big deal." I've stopped walking. I'm standing there 5 steps away, watching them kiss. They pull back from each other, and Grayson says something I don't understand in his deep, rumbly jock voice, and then he glances over Ashley's shoulder, right at me. It's clear that he recognizes me. His expression tightens into one part pity, one part I don't know what, like the sight of me brings an unpleasant taste to his mouth. The same look on his face as when he and Fohawk brought that box to our house 3 days after my brother died, when the school gathered up all remaining evidence of Tyler James Riggs and delivered it to our front door. They took Ty's name off the roster. They even expunged his school records for the year, as if they could erase his existence altogether. I'd bet good money they didn't do that kind of thing with Haley McKennett, who lost her battle with cystic fibrosis 2 years ago,
or Sammy Sullivan, who died of complications from pneumonia, or Jacob Wright, who was killed in a car crash driving home drunk from a party at Branched Oak Lake last summer.